good point. We had a very clever methods. They was partly teaching, partly books, partly methods of conference and so forth to keep the whole Atlantic Basin in good shape.
I think what comes to my mind, when we'll get to it probably in the next session, is how this free flow of ideas, including other universities, other countries, seems to me to echo kind of what took place at Bell Labs, by the sharing patents and the free flow of ideas.
Yes. Now, the Bell Laboratories was not detached from all this, of course. The solid-state era hadn't come on, but the discovery that electrons are waves was absolutely basic to all the chemistry and physics we've been talking about. And then Morgan, S. O. Morgan from here, had been one of Smythe's earliest students, joined the laboratories, and had begun work in dielectrics here. So that had attracted a lot of interest in the university world. There was, of course, Williams noted work on vitamins, which didn't have a strong impact because Princeton wasn't quite up with that. Columbia and other biochemical centers were much more active on that. Smythe was really a major link. Burns kept a good connection, though, with the inorganic work at Princeton. And Burns, of course, was very strong, and written his ACS monographs and other things, on electrochemistry, which Hewlett was the great Princeton exponent of. Now, Hewlett had a stroke just before I got there, but Hewlett never gave up. He dragged himself. His house was right next to the Frick Laboratory. He dragged himself back and forth and did some modest experiments, but Taylor and Irene and the others were just not going to tarry on electrochemistry at that point, although Irene did some theory on it. It had been the great adjunct to inorganic chemistry in the development of American chemistry beforehand. In the Bell Labs, it was still exceedingly important, and Burns was the principal exponent of Arne Burns, and you probably have a lot of stuff about Burns, but this is something that he never lost. He was a student there. He kept strong links with the faculty almost all the rest of his life. Amusing, you see, that the electrochemistry at Princeton took form only through the very elegant work of Furman in those years in analytical work, whereas here Burns kept a lot of research.
Well, speaking of, you've mentioned Smythe a number of times in the last few minutes, and I'd like to move on to your work with Smythe at Princeton. What were the circumstances in which you decided to do your thesis research?
They were derived, really, from all these background things that you've been so patient in hearing about already, namely that physical chemistry was going to be the frontier, that it had to have close link with physics, that there was something you could do with solids, with the aggregates of atoms, beyond the old idea that you only had one or two. I was much intrigued by the sophisticated instrumentation, the Shackleton Bridge, which Smythe had. Marcy's either too modest or too reserved to rise up at that point, because Shackleton's great Bell Laboratories designer, that you will have, S.P. Shackleton, that you have information on. And here was a fellow in chemistry using what seemed to us to be some of the most advanced techniques of engineering and physics, particularly electronics. So I thought this was a good thing to try. And Smythe's laboratories were full of this equipment. You can see many test tubes. I like the test tubes a little because of this work I've done with Taylor and with Pashu. But Smythe had a great concern about test tubes, in the sense that he had a great concern about purity and characterization of matter, whereas the physicists were perfectly willing to get a hold of wherever they could, and that was an attractive difference.
Well, that, just a digression, the concern with purity of materials was crucial to polymer chemistry. And that undoubtedly was a useful principle to have inculcated.
I think so, Jeff. There was very early, and you're looking at this from a very professional side, there's history involved here, namely, organic chemistry at that point, wasn't any physical organic chemistry. Organic chemistry simply did not deal with purity at the levels that we now regard as utterly essential, you see. I was interested in these organic molecules. I had done first-place dipole moments on them. That wasn't so demanding. But as soon as you began to do any kind of dielectric wave propagation studies in organic systems, you had to leap to a level of purity which the organic people felt was nonsense. You had to do that because of a thing we call Maxwell-Wagner polarization, which meant that any ions that were in there, any separate charges, were going to have a tremendous influence on the dielectric properties, on the measurements that you did. So we went into a completely different scale of effort. And Smyth, of course, demanded that. Smyth himself was not captivated by the notion of spending weeks and months on purification of organic materials, but he demanded that somebody do it, and we were the ones that did it. We didn't have chromatography. We did, it was useful for separations. We did conventional separations, but pretty largely very extended recrystallization, which the rare earth people, even though well before the time of Spedding, the classical rare earth people had really introduced. They not applied to organic materials, but they introduced this. So we did that. These are the birth pangs, and they were pretty pangy, Marcy, of the solid state. You see, if we'd known anything like fans were, we'd have been wonderful. We'd have used that for these organic structures without any. We need anything else, but we didn't.
Was there word around about the molecular stills that people were using at DuPont?
Yes.
Just getting back to that point about
recrystallization. Yes, you're thinking of Carruthers' work,
yeah,
and
Carruthers
the
and
polyester work. Oh, yes. We knew about that with enthusiasm, but not much attention paid to it until I came to the Bell Laboratories. Now, Fuller at the Bell Laboratories really understood that. It was, incidentally, a rather limiting factor. It kept DuPont from getting the polyester molecular weights, which they really should have, but it was nevertheless an important step. And we did not really understand that. For instance, it's curious, these molecular stills, as you know, were really discovered by Hickman at Eastman, which then formed a separate company called Distillation Products. They didn't apply them so much to polymers, but Hickman discovered these, and Eastman really engendered that era of organic separations, and distillation products became a very profitable and fashionable firm, as a matter of fact. Some of the earliest synthetic drugs were greatly enhanced and perhaps even produced by that molecular still system. Anyway, you see your if I give you too long answer to these
oh,
things.
Oh, no, this is, I'm very interested to hear this. As long as I brought up Carruthers and Hill's work, if you can put yourself back in the mindset of 1936, 37, 38, when you were doing this work, what was the contemporary knowledge of polymer science at the time?
Yes, very primitive. It was, on the one hand, was much stirred, other people were, by the peptide and virus work of Stanley, Chalkman, and others at the Rockefeller Institute, which was there, you see, next to the university. Now, they used to come to our seminars. We went to their seminars occasionally. I used to see Stanley getting on the bus. They had a bus. He lived in Princeton. They had a bus that went out to what's now the Forest Hall campus. And this was really quite exciting because said, well, these big molecules, and the idea, you see, was that the viruses were living structures, and yet, on the other hand, they were going to be dealt with as macromolecules, and they were having Northrop, he used to come to our seminars a lot. Taylor had a lot of respect for Northrop because he dealt with solutions. So did Kunitz, K-U-N-I-T-Z, even though there were solutions of polymer, of peptides and proteins, our people, Taylor and others, felt that they were probably legitimate. They were. This was the illegitimacy would come in if they were simply colloidal dispersions. But these people dealt with them as solutions, and they crystallized them, which is solid state again. So that was a very strong influence. Now, commercially, we had people, of course, at these seminars. New Jersey was the Bakelite origin. Bakeland himself came a time or two. Those were regarded as hopeless messes. These are phenolics, you see, and they didn't get anything out of that. There was Taylor again was the one who had the very inquiring mind here. Taylor felt sort of vaguely uneasy that chemistry hadn't done more with natural rubber, via rubber. He was curious about the proteins and the denaturation, which much changed their solubility properties, was sufficiently intriguing so that he egged Eyring into getting into that. Well, Eyring's idea of getting into it was to read everything that was known and talk to people and then get a theory, which was really quite interesting. It was before Pauling had the helix structure, Eyring had the idea of denaturing proteins in some kind of molecular change like that, you see. He didn't look terribly specific, but he published them on it. So those polymer instincts were strong, with a little curiosity about cellulose on the part of Pacu. Well, it was pretty hopeless too, but it was there, and you ought to know something about it. And this work on rubber.
Eyring had published a paper on the calculating the distance between ends of long molecules, hadn't he, in the early 30s. And there...
You're probably right, Jeff, but this is the only mean distance or probable chain there. He undoubtedly did, if you say so, but I wasn't much impressed by it.
I was just trying to get at what whether you and your graduate student colleagues and the faculty were reading... Well, this was just a couple of years after Mark and Guth's work on rubber elasticity, Kuhn's paper on first statistical mechanical analysis.
That's right. Mark and Kuhn were already still having a strong debate, which we were slightly amused by, in Geneva, and Kuhn, of course, was in Geneva. Mark, at that point, was inclined toward the colloidal dispersion still, you see, and Kuhn said, well, it can't be because we've got these molecules. I mean, you've got this all in your polymer history, which would be a very useful thing to bring out. So the result was that people at Princeton were vaguely amused, but there wasn't any very serious examination of it. I think Eyring's interest, and I must say I've forgotten the paper that you're referring to, was an exercise in statistical mechanics. He was very interested in bond rotations, and this came up, you know, in connection with the appropriate partition function for hydrocarbons, for even ethane and a few other things. And, of course, the ultimate exercise of bond rotations would be a great big molecule that had 1,000 bonds, and then you have a lot of rotations. And that's now you're making me remember that that's what he was somewhat interested in. But the polymers were regarded as rather formidable.
Were you following Carruthers' review articles and that Staudinger's publication?
I did very little. I mean, I was quite blank about this. I was much concerned with crystals and the organic thermodynamics and properties of melting and like. But Taylor had his eye on it. Taylor, of course, had DuPont connections, and he had comments about Carruthers' fibers. In terms of molecular structure, that wasn't much consequence. Now, this changed dramatically at Bell Laboratories. Bell Laboratories were right on top of it, and when I came to Bell Laboratories, and the interest I had in ester linkages and the like, we just leapt into that. You see, our interest in ester linkages with Smythe were primitive compared to what Carruthers had done, but in detail, there was a considerable overlap. Namely, we published the dielectric properties of ethyl stearate, ethyl palmitate, longer chain esters. Already, they had 20 atoms or so. This was regarded by most physical chemists as absurd. You couldn't deal with that many things together. And by the polymer chemists as nonsense, because they weren't big enough to be polymers, you see. But we studied the properties, melting properties and transition properties of acetyl alcohol at 16 atoms in the chain. So I was prepared to be stirred, which happened at the Bell Laboratories, but I wasn't stirred about polymers. I was only really interested in those peptides, but not very seriously. I didn't.
Well, that's good. You've already begun to talk about that work, which I wanted to ask you about next. Here, I think this is your first publication.
Yes, yes. And
from the J-Chem Phys.
Yes, you're quite right. And this is a tribute to the precision of the chomp, you see. And this, it is interesting, and from the point of view of history, that this was considered to be a long-chain molecule. But I must say I didn't translate that to the notion of polymers at that stage. I very quickly did when it came to the laboratories 2 years later. But this stuff was very curious because it exhibited properties you'd now call liquid crystal behavior in this narrow transition region. And it's very funny, Jeff, that the physicists, some of the most elegant physicists we have here, as Marcy knows, they are very elegant indeed, have begun to consider these phenomena in the last couple of years,
just
40 years later.
Were you the only student working on these problems with Smythe at that time?
Yes. He had a couple other students working on more conventional properties. One fellow turns up at your place. His name now is Lewis. He worked with DuPont for many years. He lives not too far from. He's rather a short chap, but he's very lively. He's quite an interesting character, George Lewis. His name then was Leotsakis, and he was Greece, perhaps one generation or so, very bright chap. He struck us, you know, because he had that natural ingenuity and, you might almost say, versatility to deal with the situation that the Greeks are noted for. So I wanted you to know that if you run into George Lewis, that's really Leotsakis, who was an early Smythe student of considerable skill. Beach, of course, was working on the electron scattering, as I mentioned. There was somebody else. There was a fellow who was doing a senior thesis that I worked with to try to help him on the instrumentation, whose name was William Kister Coors. He owns the Coors beer, and he learned something about beer. I said, you're going to have to go out there and run your father's company. You ought to realize that you can measure refractions in this stuff, even though it's so highly colored. Well, this was great news to him. He was a student, senior doing a senior thesis, because he didn't realize that the anomalous dispersion could be dealt with and that you could do certain corrections, even if you measured the refraction in the visible, you see, or in the region. So anyhow, those were students that were around.
You've actually already discussed some of the things I was going to ask you about your research projects with Dr. Smythe. Here we have a copy of a version of your dissertation from the Princeton archive, which includes...
He may be the second person that's ever written. Smythe had to look at it. Now we've got somebody else.
And this includes a series of papers that you published with... Most jointly with Smythe in the Journal of Chemical Physics and the Journal of the American Chemical Society. And looking at this with historian's hindsight, we can see that this program of research on the dielectric properties of these medium-length chains has direct relevance to what you ended up doing a couple of years later.
Oh, yes.
And I wonder if you just talk a little bit about a little bit more about that trend.
Yes, well, it was like so many of these things, I think, good stroke of fate or fortune in the sense that I was very much concerned about these chain structures by this point, and including the acetyl alcohol, but I didn't really have enough background in polymers nor was I close enough to Brothers' work to have a direct translation of this work until I saw what Bell Laboratories people were already interested in. Now, as soon as I saw that, I really did get excited because they were recognizing that Brothers' whole genesis of condensation polymers was appropriate for the era of structural and dielectric materials that we were headed for in telecommunications. We really were looking ahead. We'll get to that at the appropriate time. But the fact that those linkages were crucial in Crothers's work was not, was kind of accidental. I mean, to me, you see, I didn't really see the whole pattern. I did, just say it again, see the whole pattern in a few months going on. There is the point, Marcy, that this was a kind of frontier in solid-state chemistry and physics because the dielectric properties, the electrical properties of these things were determined by the chemical bonds that also were fundamental for their physical properties. And that was kind of news. We had a general feeling for it here in the labs because Williams and Kemp's people, a few others, had found that rubber and gutta percha were very interesting dielectrics because they had no dipoles. But they didn't realize what you could do with dipoles, which we, of course, were confronted with by Crothers' work. This is an amusing coincidence here.
Well, if before we move on to asking you more about the Bell Lab work beginning in mid-39, I wonder if I could just ask a couple of things about some other people who must have been in the Princeton department at the time. We've talked about most of the faculty. I just wondered if you've had much contact with Hubert Allier. There's another one with physical chemistry.
Yes. But Hubert, of course, was already much committed to his thing. His thing being teaching of basic chemistry to non-chemists or to chemists or to the public or to people who were really intrigued by the behavior of matter. Now, Hubert did this at his peril because Hugh Taylor had thought that Hubert was rather promising as a research fellow. He was indeed rather creative, but he thought that anybody that spent time just teaching chemistry without doing research with it was wasting their time, you see. And Hugh Taylor had very strong communications with his colleagues, and he just had to go over and take care of those freshmen, which he did, and which he's done for the rest of his career. So this is all an indirect answer to your point that Hubert's interactions with us were very modest. We had great enthusiasm. Have you ever heard of his lecture? It goes for about 50 minutes with 50 explosions. And it is a psychoacoustic visual display that you can hardly excel. And I think he still does it occasionally. I saw him not too long. It has gone around the world. One of my most detailed interactions, very much enjoyed with Hubert, was when he was doing this at the Brussels World Fair of 1958. And we happened to be over there for other things, and I helped him get some of this stuff set up. But it was a tremendous success. The whole continent of Europe felt they had understood chemistry for the first time.
So he had, by that time, he had stopped doing work on inhibition.
Yes, that was a fairly limited work. It was regarded as very promising. Amines, he used amines as chain inhibitors. He might have been one of the first to recognize in polymerization the chain modification you could get, chain transfer you could get from that. They hadn't come around then, but he didn't follow it up.
John Turkevich had just joined the staff as an instructor.
Yes, Turkevich was one of that group. Kistikowski, he followed Kistikowski, one of that group that Taylor attracted for very enterprising work in catalysis and kinetics. And Turkevich had demonstrated a lot of courage and ingenuity and got along very well with Taylor. He did some of the early deuterium catalytic work. Mm-hmm. Taylor, excuse me, I was just going to say that Taylor had a great interest in solids because they formed catalysts, and he thought there was some kind of a magic in there. He spoke of the activated points in those, and he kept lashing his graduate students to say, why don't you go out and discover this? Show me what there is there. And they never quite found it, but they did lots of good work. Taylor made me give him one of these seminars we're talking about on F-centers, which are one of the very early and elegant physics evidences in solids, which we now have an F-center laser. Little did I think when I gave that seminar, which was done with some trepidation, that we would eventually have laboratories and F-center laser, which is used around lots of other people now. This work was done largely in Germany and had to do with missing ions in halides.
Let me ask you about some of your graduate student colleagues. Walter Kautzmann got his degree a year after you left at Keith Laidler, and I wonder if you could just talk about them. Walter Moore was another.
Yes, now Walter Moore was a derivative more or less of the Turkevich Taylor era. And Walter became very much committed to teaching and with respect to modern research. I guess he retired from Australia or something. He taught in Indiana University for a long time, and then he decided, Marcy, he wanted to go to Australia. You can imagine an American physical chemist deciding to spend the rest of his career. He spent many, many years there, partly because he thought there was going to be a nuclear attack on the USA. But that's another story. Now, Kautzmann was very effective, and we had lots of exchanges. He was much committed at that stage to water, to hydration. Who was the other fellow you mentioned?
Keith Laidler?
Yes, Laidler was an Irish man who was kind of in between the Menges ion transition and the quantum statistics. And so Laidler's work was pretty much on the structure of ionic solutions. Very good, solid work, but not revolutionary.
We have an oral history with Laidler, and one of the reasons I was asking you so much about Eyring and Princeton those years, but he gave some very interesting testimony on his perception of it all.
Yes.
We like to try and combine these, to get different perspectives on the same subject.
Sure, which is a very valuable part of your enterprise, you know. Doing that is something that very few archives or historians have done. It's very interesting.
Well, let me I wonder if you'd look at this list, which is, what I've done is take a list of all the, I hope you can decipher my handwriting, it's a list of all of the people who got their degrees from Princeton around the same time you did, and just tell me if anything in particular strikes you, or if you recall anything about some of those individuals.
I remember every one of them with great enthusiasm. They're all fine people. Bobby Burwell, of course, Northwestern, had a feeling that and he's kept this as his main line of work, that these activated catalysts should be explainable in terms of solid-state structure, so he's followed that. Clark Miller was a Fermat man who really became the major technical stimulus for Lubrizol. You perhaps knew that. Years ago, but known as Bing Miller, and Lubrizol was one of the great entrepreneurial successes. It had to do with lubricants and automobiles before all the high-tech industries got going. It was about 10 or 15 years ago or so. This fellow and Professor Reserve did that. Miles was a Menges man who, as you say, Professor Stanford gave it. Bill Murray set up the pattern really for the high-quality work at the independent research institutes. His happened to be Southern, but he was followed, his work was followed very closely by Stanford and Patel and others. An excellent analytical fellow, Harold State, did just what you put down. He went to a good old liberal arts college and stayed there all the rest of his life. Bud Wheeler, who died prematurely, was another one of the fellows who paid attention to physics, quantum statistics in particular. Steve and I have already mentioned. I think they have died. Is that right? Sure he did, but he was here at every village, you say. Gene Smith died. He was a catalyst, kinetics fellow, very hardworking. Green, Pachu man, you see. Now, Green reflects what we were saying. He got some of this. Important in American chemistry and American science generally. He got some of this wonderful European virus from about you that you do things differently, you don't get in the rut, and you attack difficult problems. And while John Green is an intellectual giant, he nevertheless has had a profound effect on the Institute of Paper Chemistry. He really brought carbohydrate chemistry into cellulose technology that they had, and he's a very good example of that. Phil Elving, who died just recently, was one of the principal analytical people, a Cayley man, who appreciated the Furman work as well, but is one of the important figures. You apparently have other angles on this. In the survival of American analytical chemistry, and some of his students are now our principal resources around the country. We find this very valuable. Jack Cunningham was a razzle-dazzle fellow from